the background white noise in the room, so in case we have to manipulate the audio, we can have that sound and then cut it out.
Okay.
But that's the noise in the background that people will hear on the recording is just the white noise in this office building. So this is Karen Brewster, and today is May 6, 2019, and I am here with Julie Johnson in Boulder, Colorado. And Julie, you're going to have to tell me what this building is that we're in, because I don't...
This is the office of the City of Boulder Open Space and Mountain Parks.
Okay, and that's who you currently work for?
Correct.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your background. Where are you from originally?
Well, I'm fourth generation Colorado. My one side homesteaded out in the plains, the other was mining industry in the Idaho Springs and Georgetown area. And I'm technically the fifth generation of my family to live in Denver. I grew up on a ranch in the northeastern plains of Colorado. And then I went to the University of Denver. My degrees are in mass communications. But I started, I guess, volunteering at the Molly Brown House Museum in Denver. And I just really, really loved it. I'd always loved history, but I'm not a very fast reader. So all the history books that they would stack up and send you home, I couldn't do it. And so... I wasn't a history major, but I was really, really loved it. And so then when I was volunteering at the Molly Brown House, there's always a project, you know. The house was built in 1893, so there's always a project, and I just really got involved and really had a lot of fun with that. I ended up in Anchorage, Alaska, because I applied for a job as Anchorage Historic Properties Executive Director. And they hired me, and I had that job from 1993 until 99, I think, is when Sandy McDermott stole me away. Mm-hmm. I had one of the fun things I did at Anchorage Historic Properties was a newsletter. The cool thing about Anchorage is it's not very old. And so, at least when I was there, you know, there were so many people that were still alive that had, you know, remembered really early days. Mm-hmm. And so I got to interview them and had some really fun conversations and got to see Anchorage in a whole different way. Mm-hmm. Anchorage, you know, the Anchorage we know now has a lot of issues, but gosh, what a cool town that was, you know, when there weren't that many people. And they all talk about how much colder it was then.
Right.
And they were just, you know, it was really just kind of a family feel in that little town. And so it was great to get to know people that way. So Sandy saw that newsletter, and she loved my writing style. And she, as soon as she got money for this...
The wild, discouraging mess.
Well, she didn't know it was going to be called that yet. Neither did I. The history of the White Pass. It was such an unusual thing that she really wanted my writing style to do it. Because the White Pass really was so interesting, and she didn't want, you know, the typical administrative type history. This happened then, and so-and-so did this, you know. And as I got into the story, I could totally see why she wanted that. And
so Sandy McDermott was in the Anchorage Regional Office for the Park Service.
She was.
I don't know what her position title was.
You know, I don't know. I'm in touch with her. I could ask her.
She was
a cultural resource.
Resource something.
She was in charge of the people and cultural resources.
Right. That why a project about, you know, part of the Klondike unit... part of the Klondike Park's jurisdiction, why they, the project came out of regional instead of it from the park.
I don't know. I don't have any idea.
Okay. But it did.
It did, and I was happy to do it. And I actually was never employed by the Park Service because I didn't have a history degree. I was contract.
Okay. And that was in 99?
Yeah, I think it was 99 when I started there, yeah.
Okay. So, tell me about working on this History of the White Pass Unit project.
What do you want to know?
Well, how did you start?
So,
what was your process?
Well, the first... So I knew that I wanted the job because I hated Anchorage Historic Properties. I was in like a two-person office, and it was a lot of turnover. It was an assistant kind of position, and I worked for a board, and working for a board is just terrible. It's just horrible, and I was broke all the time, and it was really, really stressful, and so I was definitely looking for a way out of that, and then this came along. But before I accepted it, they wanted me to go down to Skagway and see Skagway and that kind of thing. And then Linda Cook was the interim superintendent at the time, and she and another person that was there, Tony Horton, I think, organized a field trip for us. And so the Park Service sent me down there with Frank Norris, and then we met Linda and Tony in Skagway, and we got on the train. Of course, I love trains anyway, so that was fun. So even if I've never even taken the job, this was such an adventure. And then we got off the first tunnel. I forget that big tunnel, you know, that goes up. Yeah. Anyway. So well, it's in there, no doubt. I've forgotten.
I don't know. Anyway.
So anyway, so they let us off at that point, and then we hiked down to White Pass City, and it was really, really rough. There had been a road when the railroad was building. There had been a road, a switchback, back and forth to White Pass City, which was at the bottom of the canyon there, and it had all been grown up with alders. So Linda was pregnant, and so she and Tony stayed up on the platform. Which turned out to be a really good thing. And I was bummed that they couldn't go, but it may have saved us. At any rate, we went down, and it was really thick with alder. You know Skagway, right. You know what that looks like. And but the reward was that we actually did see White Pass City. I mean, and, you know, I had seen a lot of diaries and photos of it, and so it was just really rewarding just to see a little bit. I mean, most of anything had melted. It's a rainforest, you know, and the materials they were using, of course, were all natural, so they were doing what they do. They were disintegrating and going back to the earth. But we did find some things, and I feel really badly now. I should have brought you some photos. There's like a door for a metal stove and something, you know, just, and, you know, like the corner of a cabin, I know we, but it was really, really marshy there, and I can't imagine there's anything left down there now.
But were there any structural remains?
That was it. I think the only, there were a couple of, like, you know, corners, mm-hmm. where the, you know, where the joints, the dovetails would be still in position and still kind of there, but it was so wet and, you know, crumbling even as we were standing there, so I can't imagine anything that's still there.
Why did they build in such a marshy spot?
Where else were they going to build?
I don't know.
They didn't care.
Yeah.
They were just there to mine the miners. They didn't, you know.
So, yeah, why did White Pass City was...
White Pass City was a stopping point along the way for a place to sleep and eat and get food poisoning from everybody's, from the diaries. If you read the diaries at White Pass, it was pretty awful. And then get some supplies. And I think it had something to do with the Bracket Wagon Road too, I forget. But
yeah, it was before the toll spot.
I think so. I think past that it was a toll. But you'd have to read the book to, because I actually don't remember, but I think it did have something to do with the Bracket Wagon Road. I have seen the Bracket Wagon Road before White Pass City, so I know it existed before that, and have walked on that, and that was really cool. But anyway, so back to, you know,
your hike. Yeah.
Yeah, back to the hike. Up was really challenging, and one of the alders, there was a hiker ahead of me, and one of the alders snapped back and cut my eye, and it's okay. I mean, it healed and everything. It was a little weird, but one of the weird things that did happen, and I've hiked hundreds of miles in Alaska and here in Colorado, and I've only seen one fairy ring. You know what that is?
No.
It's just a level spot. It was a small circle, about twice the size of this table, so maybe 4 to 5 feet in circumference. And you know how dense the vegetation is in the rainforest, and it's a little place where there's no vegetation at all. It's just like dirt and moss and totally clear. Hmm. And I didn't take a photo of it. Well, I was actually, I think I was out of film. This is way back in the day of film. So it wasn't like, you know, I had my cell phone with me. And but it was really cool. And we stopped for a moment. And because I don't, you know, I don't know what causes fairy rings, but it was really an interesting thing. And then about halfway up, and we're climbing, and the alders are not easy to climb in, as you know. And I'm like, you know, we realized that, you know, that the mountain, the tunnel goes through the mountain. So what if we're climbing on top of the tunnel?
Oh.
How are we going to know? Because we were still below tree line. So that's when we started hollering for Linda and Tony. And then they answered us back, and so we could find them. I've thought about that a lot of times, like, wow, we were so lucky that they stayed back. And so that, you know, what an adventure. That was just so freaking much fun. And then got back, and the next day, you know, all the seasonals and stuff wanted to know about the trip and how cool it was. And it really, really was fun. And the train, you know, the train stopped, and we got on and went back, and I just kind of fell in love with Skagway at that point and with the project, and so it's the rest is history.
And being able to visit a place that you're going to write about and experience it makes a big difference.
Yeah, that was really fun. And you know, I'm sure that there are people that go down to White Pass City now. I think the train stops somewhere around there, so that you can hike up to a glacier.
Right.
But, White Pass City was down, and it's steep. So I feel pretty privileged to have seen it.
Yeah. And then tell me about the Bracket Wagon Road.
So you can ask Carl more about this. This was when I was into the project more. I'll be honest, and everybody in the office would tell you, I fell in love with George Bracket. I mean, he was not an entrepreneur. But, you know, this was, and I called it in the book, I call it Grand Victorian Bravado. They just do it. Right. They're like, okay, sure, I'll do it. Because they had to. They didn't really have any choice. He had like 7 sons or something like that. And you know, what are you going to do with them? Put them to work, you know. And so he built a wagon road. It was originally a toll road was the idea. But of course, with all the craziness, it kind of was swept away, and I think he lost his shirt on the project. But he did. Oh yeah, I know this office is not soundproof even in the slightest. Mm-hmm. I think he had a great time, and I know his sons did. I think they just had a wonderful time working on this. But he lost investors, and a lot of things went south for him. And he actually ended up back in, I think, St. Paul. And then he had a son that lived in Denver, and I found some of the letters that he wrote to his son in Denver. But I just think George Bracket was just a really, really interesting person. So you'll have to ask Carl where this was, but there's a big pipeline that goes over the river. Mm-hmm. And I was really excited about going to see that. A bunch of us were going to see the park superintendent, and I forget his name, and his wife, and Carl, and another historian. We were going to go see the Bracket Wagon Road. I was so, so, so excited. And then Carl said, well, you do have rubber sole shoes. And I'm like, what? Because you have to walk over the pipeline.
Oh.
And so Carl can tell you where that is. He would know for sure. And I tend to be somewhat afraid of heights, but I made it over because I just wanted to see the Bracket Wagon Road so badly. It did have one rail on it, and at the time, pretty much every time I stayed in Skagway, I kind of stayed at the White House, mm-hmm. the Tron Roots. And I asked John. He's like, oh, you'll be fine. If it doesn't rain, you'll be fine. It did not rain. And so So, but we got to walk on the Bracket Wagon Road, which was really exquisite. It was really, really cool. And that would have been well before you got to White Pass City.
Yeah. Maybe we should step back a little to explain the White Pass unit and what the White Pass is versus
the Chilkoot,
because everybody's heard of the Chilkoot.
Well, sure, and I get that because you can hike it, and I've hiked part of it. I've never actually gone over the pass. I've been on the other end of it, but from the train,
right?
You know, I think it's just because it's more accessible, people, and there's that picture of the golden,
right,
you know.
But the White Pass, the reason George Brackett was going to put a road in was the idea that as an alternate route to the
Well, Gulf I think Coast. It was, I think it, I think it was lower and more gradual. Mm-hmm. I think because, you know, the Chilkoot has ups and downs, but then it's got that last really steep climb, the Golden Staircase. And the White Pass was more of a gentle incline. And I'm pretty sure that's why they were putting the road there. And this was before the railroad. And I think the White Pass just, this is going to sound, well, you've spent time in Skagway. So there's the group that comes to hike, mm-hmm. and you know, the younger, more fit, probably, group goes to Chilkoot. And then the cruise passengers get on the train and they go up the White Pass. And I love the train, but the stories they tell are horrible. I mean, to say that they're, you know, it's drama, it's incorrect, it's Disney-fied. It's not even, no, Disney would do a better job than
romanticized, than sort of?
Well, very much more drama. I mean, in fact, one of the things they said about George Brackett was that he left Skagway a bitter, broken man, and there's nothing further from the truth. I mean, he's like, oh, I get to go home, and, you know, I mean, he was not broken, and he was not bitter.
But he was maybe not the millionaire he had hoped to be.
I don't know if he wanted to be a millionaire. You know, I think, you know, like, the railroad people, I mean, they had investors, but the people that actually worked there, I think they were in it because they liked the work.
Well, and also they were in it, you know, for the money, in the sense that not everybody who was in the gold rush was out mining. There's
no
all that support.
No,
people.
In fact, really, you know, I mean, this is not just my supposition, but, you know, the people that made most of the money made it off the miners.
Yeah.
Except for our friend Nordstrom, who actually, I think he did get enough gold to come back and start a shoe store in Seattle.
Yes, that's, I believe.
And I
so.
Was really sad because I really wanted to use that story, but it was on, he was on the Chilkoot and not the White Pass, so I didn't get to use that story.
Yeah, I'm looking at the book to see what it says about how George Brackett got involved. I think, didn't he come from a surveying background?
Yeah, I think so, because his notes are in the back of the book.
Yeah.
Because they were just so beautiful, and he had fabulous handwriting in it. You know, it was almost like a family reunion that he had. He had one of his sons, what was her name, Molly? Molly Brackett had a photograph book that you could find in any bookstore in Skagway. Mm-hmm. Kind of a different angle.
Yeah, somehow I think, well, I don't remember if it was Brackett or something, I kind of remember, had been in a, well, maybe that was Heaney who built the railroad, came from a, having already done similar construction planning.
Yeah,
elsewhere.
Heaney was a very interesting guy.
What do you remember about him while I'm looking this up?
I think he was just one of those guys that just did it, you know? He was kind of like George Brackett. You just did it. You just did what you have to do. But he loved what he did, and I do believe he had experience. Now, the one of the engineers that worked with him on the project, gonna forget his name, but he, because of the, you know, the topography of the White Pass, it was gonna have to be narrow gauge. And because Colorado also has narrow gauge, the engineer was actually from Denver, and he was the same one that did the Moffett, the train that goes up to the Moffett Tunnel. And so, you know, they were just really fascinating people that just did what they wanted to, you know.
Yeah. Well, in the book, I just found this part about White Pass City, and it you say in the book it was a stopping spot for stampeders before the ascent of Dead Horse Gulch, a construction camp for the Brackett Wagon Road, and finally construction camp for the upper stretches of the White Pass Railroad. Town's purpose was to provide rest and services to stampeders and packers on their way over the summit. And then when the train came through, the town outlived its purpose. And the train was February of 1899. And the town was deserted as quickly as it sprouted in late 1897. So it did have a short life. But here, this is part about George Brackett.
Yeah, there's a book, like a little memoir of some kids that grew up in Skagway, and pictures of them. They would go have picnics at the old, you know, the ghost town in White Pass.
Yeah.
But it was quite a bit easier to get to. I don't think the vegetation was quite as big as it is now.
Yeah, and if the parts of the Brackett Road were still hikeable, then it might have been possible. Well, here you say Brackett. Oh, he was a butcher during the Civil War. So, well, not a butcher. He supplied meat to the regiment. Miller. Oh, he was made overseer of the highways and later supervisor of Minneapolis Township. And then, yeah, survey party for the North Pacific Railroad. So he did have background and all that. Built a section of the Canadian Pacific west of Winnipeg. He'd been to Alaska as a tourist.
Yeah, tourism. Yeah, in fact, I believe they went through the south, up from Juneau, I think, maybe, from Vancouver.
From Pacific Coast Steamship, yeah. Inside Passage.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
there was actually a lot of tourism even back then.
Yeah, it's amazing because this was 1890.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the Victorians, they had, I mean, some, depending on what you did, you know, there was expendable income, and they did have the luxury of travel.
Yeah. And it says that his son, Jim Brackett, went to Skagway in August 1897 with a load of cattle. To serve the miners. And then his other son built Brackett Trading Post. I'm just trying to see what George, how he ended up doing the wagon road. He met Acklin, congressman.
Yeah, I don't remember all the specifics.
Oh, it was the Skagway and Yukon Transportation Company, and then they must have hired him. Because I was trying to figure out how he got there. And then you say they had investors.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting part of the White Pass story is the horses.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. When I first took on the project, most people just wanted to know how many horses, because I think, what do they say on the railroad, like 1,000 horses or something? I don't even remember the number. But 1,000 horses died. And I, people wanted to know, well, how many exactly? Well, who knows? I mean, it was so crazy. I mean, and so the title of the book came from a quote from John Muir. When he landed in Skagway and Dyea, he described it as a wild, discouraging mess because there was so much activity. It was ridiculous what was going on. And it was clear that none of these people, or very few of the people, had any experience with horses, where they were lowering them down and not feeding them. And so easily hundreds of horses did die. But you know, on the railroad they say 1,000 horses or 2,000, whatever they say, it's impossible. And I even went to the archives and went through a bunch of bills of lading to see how many, but even that can't be accurate because, you know, the ships came and they dumped and, you know, nothing got recorded. And so I don't think it's accurate. In fact, I know it's not.
In the chapter, The Dead Horse Trail, where you introduce it, you say, most commonly repeated figure declares 3,000.
3,000.
But then you say 3,800 were registered by customs, but who knows?
Yeah, it's impossible to know. But that aside, I tried to make the story about the horses. And one of the coolest things about this project was just sitting in that Klondike library and reading the first person accounts and reading the diaries. And that's fairly controversial in the history world, and I don't know why. Well, I don't think it's as controversial as it used to be. I have had colleagues, and one of them might have been at the Park Service, who, if it wasn't published, it wasn't right. It wasn't history. And I'm like, well, but if it's something published, then it's somebody's interpretation, and it's generally some white guy
right.
who thinks he knows everything. And has written his opinion and called it history. And it's just the human nature. It's just the way it is. We can't write something without having our opinion in it somewhere. Mm-hmm. A journalist can try to be as fair and impartial as possible, but it's still, you know, we're still humans.
Right.
It's impossible not to tell the story from our point of view. And that's why I like the diaries so much, because the diaries were talking about the things. They were talking about the horses, and numerous accounts talked about horses committing suicide. Well, I grew up with horses, and they're really smart, and I love them to death, but I just didn't know. I mean, they know cause and effect. Like if you go out with a halter and they're not in the mood to work, they'll run. So they know that part of cause and effect, but I'm pretty sure that they didn't know that they were going, if they jumped off a cliff, they were going to die, then kill themselves and be out of misery. I just couldn't make that connection. So from the Anchorage office, I called CSU, Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and talked with Temple Grandin. She's a wonderful woman. And she's in the in their veterinary agriculture school, and she's autistic, and she has done a lot of research on cattle and horses and that kind of thing. And so I talked to her, and it was really interesting. And she agreed with me. I mean, I sent her the diaries, and we had a really interesting and just fascinating phone conversation about how they just, you know, horses don't make that cause and effect. However, they were starving. Most of them were starving. And if they were eating moss, because there's really nothing along the White Pass that's mm-hmm. appropriate for a horse to eat. There just isn't. And these guys weren't, they didn't want to waste the space on the horse's back for hay. And so they were starving, and they could have been hallucinating or just so weak that they fell down the side of the mountain, because some of those are pretty, you know, some of those portions of that trail are pretty slick and just really deadly. And if a horse is, you know, if he's not balanced properly and he's exhausted, and it's a lot of bad things happen, that's for sure. But I did put in the book, and I do feel this. I mean, we feel differently about animals now, and, you know, they're our friends, they're our pets, but for the most part, they really weren't then. Mm-hmm. They were more property. And I'm not going to say that people didn't love their horses, because there's a little story in the back of that woman in Seattle.
Right.
But it was different.
They were their laborers. Sort of.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's one thing that really bugs me about, you know, history. And we live today in this year, and we look at what happened 100 years ago with our judgmental filter,
right,
and judge the people that did those things by our standards today. And I don't really think that's fair. And these people were also starving.
Right.
And I actually disagree with the fact that, or the theory that many of them wanted the adventure. I actually disagree with that. I think they were really, most of them were just really desperate for employment. They were desperate for money. And they heard about, you know, the strike. Unfortunately, for most of the people that went up there, news traveled very, very slowly mm-hmm. back in the day. And, you know, now if somebody had that kind of a strike, we'd know it probably in half an hour. It might pop up on my cell phone. CNN right. reports, you know, big, big gold strike. George Carmack, you know. But then, you know, it was months.
Right.
And so by that time, all the, you know, most of the claims had been staked. So it was a really pretty desperate time, and a lot of the people died as well. And
right.
we need to remember that and, to, you know, not be judgmental about them. And trust me, that's hard
right.
for me, because I love those horses, and the stories and the photos are terrible.
Yeah. I didn't know that part of the story till I read your book.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I don't know all that history. And
yeah, it's also known as a dead horse trail. So I guess I did know it. I knew it more. I think I knew it. And I lived in Alaska for a long time, so I think I knew it as a dead horse trail before I knew it as a white pass.
Yeah, and I guess I know more about the Chilkoot, because that's, you say, the more popularized one, and they couldn't really take horses over the Chilkoot, over the summit. Maybe they took them up.
I think they tried in a couple of different ways, but yeah, it just wasn't, yeah.
So wasn't. That's why so many more horse deaths on the White Pass, is they were just using them more.
Oh, yeah. I think they just barely went up to sheep camp, mostly,
yeah.
on the Chilkoot. I mean, there were horses, but they didn't go all the way, for sure.
Right. And as you say, that the people using the horses, they were not wealthy people, and
no.
they needed their own supplies, so they didn't have either the money or the space for hay. And why they couldn't figure out that horses still need to eat.
Why do my neighbors not know that dogs have to eat, and why is the dog barking all the time? I don't know. Why do my neighbors let their cats out so they can, I don't know. People, yeah, I don't have answers.
Yeah.
People suck, and they still do.
Yeah. But, and then I assume the horses, they fell off the trail, or they were just left there.
Oh, yeah.
They were not, nothing was done with their bodies. Were any of them salvaged for meat?
Well, if you read some of the White Pass diaries, probably. Because some of the restaurants, we're guessing, were serving that, and a lot of people got sick.
And that's so. Why the people got sick?
Yeah, well, probably that and a number of reasons are probably drinking from the creek. And
yeah.
Yeah, and the stress. I mean, this has got to be terrible stress for them, too. So.
Right, and they weren't, as you say, the men weren't eating very well themselves, probably.
Mm-mm.
And sanitation was probably non-existent.
Oh, I can't imagine there was anything at all, yeah. Yeah, you didn't hear about outhouses out in White Pass City. Skagway, obviously, but not, I don't remember any. I mean, they couldn't have dug. I mean, I can't
really,
imagine.
Is it permafrost?
No, I don't think so, but pretty rocky.
Really?
Yeah, the rocks under all that marsh, I think. Yeah, I don't think it would be possible.
So you say something about the horses. I can't remember. Eating moss. Was there something in the chemicals in the moss that might make them hallucinate?
There could have been, and that was one of the things that Temple Grandin thought of. You know, moss is not something that a horse would eat unless they're really, really desperate, and probably there's something.
Some chemical compound thing. So why did you decide to go to Alaska in the first place?
Oh, well, my mom moved up there in 1980, and then my brother was stationed at Elmendorf. He's a pilot. And he and his wife had just started having babies. And then I, this is a pretty common story. My boyfriend was a doctor, and so he was going to go work in Bethel, pay off his student loans. And so then I saw this ad for Anchorage Historic Properties Executive Director, and that's why. I mean, I'd been up there a number of times, so I kind of knew what I was getting into.
Mm-hmm. I know what I was going to ask you, which was about the diaries and how some academic historians maybe didn't look at that as valid. I thought diaries and those kinds of things is primary source. That should be what you'd be looking at.
I agree.
But that was not the sentiment?
That was not the sentiment of one of my coworkers.
Okay. But, I mean, and I think that's what makes your book interesting, is you have lots of quotes, first-person accounts.
They already told the story. Yeah. All I did was put it together.
Yeah.
I mean, they told the story. And this is interesting, too. And I don't think this is in the book, but one of the diaries talked about a monster in the river. And I have meant to write to Ewan Ivey. Have you read her books? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the second book, she talks, you know, her husband is out kind of where this has occurred, talking about a monster in a river. You remember that part?
There's a monster in the lake.
In our lake, yeah. Yeah. And so I keep meaning to write to her. Well, to tell her, I mean, maybe she knows about it. Maybe that's where she got it. I don't know.
Her that book, which the name I can't remember.
The Bright Side of the Earth or something like that.
Yeah, and it's sort of, when I read it, to me, it was a little bit of a historical fiction kind of based on the Allen mm-hmm. expedition up yeah. the Copper River.
Yeah.
And that's in Athabascan country, mm-hmm. Otna country. And so I was wondering if that idea of a monster in the lake comes from a traditional Otna story, because it's in their region.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I think, and then there was another diary, and this I think you can explain, but the mountains, how the mountains were moving, and I think that's just like a mirage mm-hmm. kind of thing, but it was, I mean, the guy was truly terrified.
Because he saw the mountains moving?
Yeah, he was truly terrified. And if you can think about it, a city kid from, you know, I mean, think how terrifying this would be.
Yeah.
I mean, the mosquitoes alone would be horribly terrifying. I mean, awful.
One, as you say, they didn't know how to use horses, and then you arrive in Skagway and you get a couple of horses to carry your stuff and...
Oh, no, it would be terrifying. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know how they knew what they... Well, they didn't know what
they
were
doing. Well, they didn't.
Or they followed some other stampeder.
Well, yeah, you look at the photo on the cover. I mean, right. They didn't know.
Yeah. Well, it's great. This one guy on the right, I didn't look at it before, but his expression looks a little bit befuddled and like, what did I get myself into?
Well, exactly. And it's the kind of thing you get that far into it. What do you do? Go back?
Well, in some cases, I think, at least on the Chilkoot, I think they got to sheep camp and mm-hmm. realized they were in more than they could and turned around. And I don't know about White Pass.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure some did, but not enough.
I don't think you remember the numbers. But, I mean, you know about the horses dying on the trail. What do we know about people dying on the trails?
I don't remember.
Did that fall into your research?
Probably.
So in putting this book together, so you were sort of given this assignment, do a history of the White Pass unit. How did you decide the themes to look at and...
Well, since it had been called the Dead Horse Trail, and most of the people at the Park Service unit were in Anchorage, how many horses? So that's kind of where the thrust was. And then my love of trains. I mean, that was an obvious connection. The Bracket Wagon Road was just kind of a bonus thrown in. I didn't know anything about that when I got there. And, you know, gold is in my family. So my grandfather, great-grandfather, built Argo Mill, which is in Idaho Springs. And Grandpa Ruth was a miner as well. So I kind of had that connection. I mean, it was, so the first time I was in Skagway by myself, to do research was in April. And that's before the tourists get there. And so, but things are starting to wake up, you know, the coffee shops are coming back and, you know, people are starting to come and rest. There were two restaurants open. One was open for lunch, one for dinner, and then you just hope they didn't get it screwed up so that they were both open at lunch and nobody for dinner. And one was a really good Italian place. It was in Captain Moore's house.
Oh.
I don't remember the name of it, but it was really good. So I talked to the people of the town. I mean, they live there. They know the stories, you know, the Rapuzzi stories and all that. And so I kind of got their angle. And then, you know, truthfully, I just sat down and took the files out and started reading the diaries. The story wrote itself, to be honest, because, you know, I took it from those diaries. And
no, they had diaries that were specific to White Pass?
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And with particular people's names associated with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't been in that library for many years, so I don't know how it's...
Was that the Klondike Parks Library? Mm-hmm. So, or their archives?
Yeah, it's a Park Service Library. And it was, it wasn't fancy. It was just a room, maybe twice the size of this, and we just walk in, sit down, and yeah, it was great.
What was it in the archives where you had to have it pulled out and wear white gloves and all that?
No.
It's their library in the admin building?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would think those, maybe they have copies of diaries.
Probably. Yeah. I don't know. It's been a long time since I remember.
So how long did the project take you?
Oh, a couple years. My mom got sick while I was doing this. She got lung cancer, so that slowed the process down. It probably would have been a 2-year project, but it ended up, I think, a 3-year project because of that.
It does seem like, as you say, reading those diaries and everything, that it would be a fairly overwhelming amount of material.
But it was awesome. It was so much, overwhelming. I guess that's, you can look at it that way.
In terms of how do you decide how to narrow it down into a reasonably length?
Well, what tells a story? You know, like the guy that wrote The Moving Mountains, that doesn't tell the story. What tells this story? And that was how I, you know, and sadly I couldn't use the Nordstrom story, because even though I think it's a fabulous story, I couldn't use it, so.
Right. And you also have in here, you know, background chapters on other history to sort of set it in context of Skagway and the Gold Rush.
Well, and one of the chapters in there was kind of controversial when I first announced I was going to do it. Or at least I was working on it. And it's the one about the Victorian lifestyle. And it was interesting because there was a very conservative type of historian at the Alaska office, or the Anchorage office, and he just didn't understand why I would do that, because I had I did a timeline. You know, this happened, Silver Crush, blah, 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 you know, all the way up to the Titanic going down. And it ended up scooting it all the way to 9/11 at the end of the book. So he just thought that was crazy. He didn't understand why that would happen. And so I went ahead and the Victorians are fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely fascinating. So much happened. I mean, for one thing, Queen Victoria lived a long time, so, you know, we're talking about 100 years lifespan. So a lot of things happened, but they're also really, really fascinating people. You know, books were suddenly more affordable. Travel was possible. They had, they were interested in travel and you know, Audubon was busy. I mean, it was a really fascinating time. And so the Victorian chapter was actually, Sandy loved it, and the guy that didn't understand why it would be in this book, he's like, it works. He's like, good. You're right, it works. Because it explains a lot, I hope it explains a lot about what was going on in these people's lives. I mean, they didn't, you know, it's not like you and me, well, you know, this sounds like fun, I could be there by 11 kind of thing. I mean, this was a huge thing,
right.
And so there was a lot of stuff going on. There was a lot of energy behind all of this, and I think it just helped to understand a little bit.
Yeah, it sets the context, and I think it sets the context for, not necessarily for the miners, but for the people who went to create the community around the mining.
For sure, and the people that grubstaked, you know, and that kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely.
And then, as you said, just, you know, the travelers who went to Skagway by ship just to go.
And there were tourists. That's the crazy thing. There were tourists even at the height of the gold rush.
Yeah, I don't know that Skagway would have been someplace I would have wanted to go that I'd been that period. You know, maybe by 1910 it would have been okay.
I know.
No, but I think you're right. It helps set the scene just as much as you set the scene for, you know, why people went to mine or why people, you know, what life was, you know, in the native story of White Pass.
Yeah.
You know, all that's important context.
It's a pretty fascinating place, and I mean, a lot of the White Pass story is also the Chilkoot, because obviously Dyea's right there, and people, you know, so a lot of the history is the same, but different. And the train was interesting, too. I don't know if you remember the article or the chapter about the Close brothers. They were fascinating.
Are they the ones who did the train?
They were the investors, the financiers, okay. And they're from London. Mm-hmm. And I actually went to London and met some of the Close brothers. It was, I mean, they're still in business today.
And I don't remember how they got involved in funding it.
You know, I'm not sure I remember either. There's a really good book about it, though. I'm not sure. I don't remember. But they really got into it. I mean, they were...
This is that they were concerned about the delays.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the other thing that's interesting to contrast from then to today was, and I forget how many people were killed during the building of the White Pass Railroad, but I think it maybe 30. And they were bragging about how it was such a safe workplace because only 30 people died. Like, whoa!
Let's see.
We can't even leave electrical cords out in the hallway.
Right, and yeah, here it's, you know, zero. You know, nowadays it's a zero tolerance.
Mm-hmm. They're like, oh yeah, only 30 people died, that's awesome.
Well, you know, building a railroad, that probably was pretty good in those days. Mm-hmm. Let's see.
The train would never be built today. Never.
The Close brothers had land in Iowa for farming. Which they didn't sound like they didn't do very well at. How they finance land? Through British Columbia.
Oh, yeah.
Wilkinson was an agent for British Columbia Development Syndicate, and he had connections to England and London, and somehow that's... So the Close brothers loaned him money to start, and then that eventually became that they were investors. So,
yeah, and I was there, oh gosh, the 100th anniversary of the rail? I guess it would have been the 100th anniversary. And I got to go up on the steam engine, and there were people from Close brothers, and it was really fun.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Cool.
Yeah, the steam engine was really fun.
So, you know, as I said, you know, the White Pass unit sort of gets ignored a little bit. So what, besides, you know, you've already told some of the stories, but what is it important from your perspective that you think people should know?
Well, I think, I would like them to, think about how desperate these people were. You know, they weren't cruel people. They were everyday people, but they did cruel things to the animals. There were a lot of crooks. Of course, you know, where there are people, there are crooks. I think, and I don't know how you would do this on the train, but I don't feel like they do a very good job of talking about the amount of activity that was there. What it would have looked like. And I just think, you know, we lose so much in history, I think, simply because it's just told so poorly. Names and dates, you're like, yeah, whatever. But, you know, when you can bring it back to who the people were and what they were afraid of, and, you know, the letters home, you know, I miss my wife, I miss my girlfriend, I miss my mom, you know. Right. You know, they were people, and there was a lot going on in the world. We get so, and I do it too, I go home and I watch the news and I'm like, oh my God. But this is, you know, this is not our first rodeo, mm-hmm. you know, it's, I feel like we should be able to learn from these people. They went through a really horrible time, and they survived. And, you know, they did it because they had to. You know, they just did it because they had to. I just feel like, I don't want to get on my soapbox. We just whine so much about the littlest things and these people and the things that they did. And some of them actually really loved the adventure, you know, and I don't think they went up there necessarily for the adventure, but some of them really, really loved it. And was it Martha, the woman that went up with her first husband and he decided not to go up in Chilkoot and she went over anyway?
Not Martha Moore.
Anyway, she ended up living in Canada for a long, you know, for the rest of her life. And she actually went over the Chilkoot while she was pregnant and in heels and a corset, no doubt.
Heels? I'm not, well, I guess heeled boots, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was actually one of my questions was, in this research, did you find out about the role of women and or children, families?
So, I don't know much about children. I don't think children really went, and there weren't very many women. The woman that had the boarding house, what was her name?
That wasn't Martha, was it?
Pullen.
Oh, Harriet Pullen?
Yeah.
Yeah, in Skagway itself.
Yeah, yes. In Skagway itself. I think Skagway is kind of where there were more women. I think I did not see anywhere... I didn't see any diaries of a woman going up Dead Horse Trail. I think there were tourists, and there are some tourist accounts, and I can't remember the name. And they tend to be from England.
Yeah, you had here. I just missed it.
But women making money and going to mine, I don't really.
Yeah, here you have excursionists Mary Hitchcock and
That's
Edith
it.
Van Buren.
Yep.
But they were tourists.
They were tourists.
And, yeah, so I was wondering if there's any indication of women on the White Pass or in White Pass City having businesses. Or...
Not that I recall.
So in the diaries, they didn't talk about the women along the way.
No, women were too, if they were, women were too busy to write in a diary.
No, I was thinking if the men wrote about interactions with women.
No, I don't recall. I mean, it's totally feasible that there would have been, and, you know, like working in the restaurants and mm-hmm. in the hospitality
right.
industry in White Pass City, but I don't remember any enterprising... Any entrepreneurs.
And the White Pass Trail, White Pass City was the main place?
Mm-hmm. There were toll places along the way, but I think for the most part they were torn down and ignored by the stampeders because they didn't want to pay.
Right.
And brackets, people didn't have the manpower to, you know, the guns to make them stay.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting to think about that being a toll road.
Well, I mean, think about how expensive it was. How else is it going to recoup that investment?
Right.
There's no way to, our roads aren't privately built anymore for that very
right.
reason. I mean, there's no reason to build such a road. The train, sure, you know, you can charge it, you know, you can charge for a ticket before
right.
you get on the train. But if you're on that road and they refuse to pay, what are you going to do? and I think there was probably a lot of violence, and they just gave up because the stampeders just weren't going to pay, period.
Yeah.
So I think all those toll spots along that, they were very short, very short-lived.
In the diaries and the research, was there any mention of law enforcement along the road or the trail?
No. I think it was probably a fairly lawless place. Until they got to the summit, and then there would be the Mounties would be waiting for them. And I know there was a boundary dispute. This is during Roosevelt's administration, where the U.S. began, mm-hmm. and I think the Mounties solved that problem just with placing a Gatling gun at where they thought the boundary was. I'm like, oh, here you are.
Right. So they had to do the same boundary issues in White Pass as they would at Chilkoot.
Correct.
It was still enforced by the Canadians.
Yep.
And the 1,200 pounds.
You know, I don't know about the 1,200 pounds on White Pass. I don't remember. Probably assume so, but...
I mean, I know you mentioned it in the book, but I don't remember if that's in the chapter, you know, the kind of contextual chapter of the Gold Rush or not, or if it's specific to White Pass.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Well, here's a good quote. We were talking about the difference between the Chilkoot and the White Pass. Oh, Martha Ferguson McGowan, that's probably who you were thinking.
Yep.
Quote, "There ain't no choice," said an old-timer, "of choosing between the Chilkoot and the White Pass. One's hell, the other's damnation." So which was which?
Well, I guess it would depend on any given day.
So Martha Ferguson McGowan, she was the one you were talking about. She ran a roadhouse or something?
No, she was headed to the Klondike with her first husband, and then he decided not to do it, and she went anyway. And she ended up marrying somebody else in Canada somewhere, and I forget where she lived. Kind of a fascinating person.
Yeah. I mean, as I think, you know, some of these women, I mean, they're all fascinating, but the women's stories tend to not be as obvious. And, you know, it was tough for anybody, and then to think women did it. Well, here's a photo right here of French camp near Liarsville, White Pass Trail, Ashill Curtis photo, and there's a woman right there.
Yeah, Liarsville. Yeah, that was like, I mean, that's, I guess it would be the north part.
Three and a half miles from the Lynn Canal.
It's along the river there. I think there's some houses there now where people live.
Well, here you say it was the end of the easy part of the journey.
That's why it was a lie. Yeah.
And maybe that's why she was there. Maybe who knows if she went on.
It was the lie.
Because you thought, oh, this was going to be like this the whole way.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got worse.
Yeah.
So what else did you learn about the people and the lifestyle from those diaries?
Well, I think in my mind, you know, I know Pierre Burton had them as juggernauts, as, you know, these adventurers, and they, you know, they went on this for an adventure, and I really honestly didn't, no doubt there were some that were on for the adventure. But I just really thought that they were, you know, considering what was going on, the economy and the rest of the country, I think they were mostly really desperate. And
what other things did they say in the diaries? I mean, you said, like, they were homesick?
Oh, yeah. Well, they were sick most of the time, too. I mean, there were some people, you know, with pneumonia, and I know that they have food poisoning pretty much all the time. So they were really sick. And they had to be exhausted. They had to be, you know, scared.
Cold? Did they talk about the weather?
Oh, can you imagine what they smelled like? You know, they didn't have Gore-Tex like we do, you know? And, you know, and I'm up on the, and actually with Carl Gerke, I'm up on the summit in the cloud, and, you know, it's cool and it's misty and it feels good to us. But, you know, I was, you know, I was wearing modern day hiking, and I had hiking boots, and I had wool socks, and you know, these people had cotton and wool, and that was pretty much all they had, and it was wet all the time, and I can't imagine that. I mean, probably a lot of people died from hypothermia and lost, for you know, limbs from frostbite and that kind of thing.
Were they going over in all seasons?
Oh yeah. Yeah, in fact, it looks like it might actually have been somewhat easier, you know, with the Chilkoot as well, somewhat easier in the wintertime because the snow would make the trail smoother.
But definitely
a little chillier.
Yeah.
Although summer, you know, summer can suck up there too. You know, especially with the wind, the way the wind howls throughout out there. So, and it's wet. And
there, on the White Pass, is getting the wind and cold off those glaciers? Are they closer to the glaciers on that side than on the Chilkoot?
I guess so. I just remember that when I was in Skagway, man, the White Pass, you know, that wind would come up Lynn Canal, and, you know, the White Pass is the point of least resistance, and it just howls, as you know.
Yes.
Walking through, I mean, it's not, you know, from the White House to the Klondike, you know, to the office. Yeah, it's not a long walk, but, you know, when the wind is coming this way and the ice pellets are hitting you, it's a long walk.
Yeah. I was thinking, well, you know, other things that might be in people's diaries, you say that what they might have been eating or not eating.
Well, I think they, you know, they had stuff from home. I would not venture, well, I might even have a list in there somewhere of the kinds of things they were eating. I don't remember.
And did they, you know, you mentioned the weather and the gear. I would think their feet would have been a mess. Did they talk, were there any mention of that?
Oh, I'm sure there was. I'm sure. I don't remember.
You don't remember. Yeah, I was thinking if there are little tidbits you remember from the diaries that stood out besides the monster in the river.
No, just mostly being homesick. I'm really wanting a real cup of coffee. I do remember that. I don't really remember.
Well, and then the selecting what quotes to put in here, that's my, like, gosh, you must have had so much material.
I did.
You know, it's one thing to, you know, pull it together in your narrative and go through the flow of a storyline, but how do you decide what quotes to use?
The ones that are the most colorful, the ones that will be the most memorable, the ones that tell the story that you want to illustrate the most.
And then the photographs, how did you locate all these photographs?
Oh, man, that cost a bunch of money. well, luckily, we were at the beginning. I mean, now it would be a lot easier, I think. But we were at the beginning of digitalization. And so I was able to get some photos from different places and see them digitally. The Close Brothers actually even sent me a photo. There was one, the archives in Victoria has a wonderful collection of photos, but they were ridiculously expensive, so I think I only used one or two photos. I mean, they were photos that I had never seen before, which, you know, you do the research,
right,
and you see the same photos over and over and over and over again. Well, these were photos, really interesting photos I had never seen, and but they were just awful to work with. They sent me to, even though this is for the Park Service, and I'm, you know, it's not going to be for sale, but it's a different government, so they sent me to their commercial division for film, and I'm like, no, I'm not doing that, and they were going to charge a great deal of money, and the archivist said, well, we are not in the business of sharing our photos. I'm like, well,
but you're an archives. What is your business?
I kind of wanted to ask her that, and so I think there's only one or two photos, because it was like $1,400 for two photos, and I'm like, this is ridiculous. I did have to pay for the rights, but that.
And how did you find that that archive had that collection?
Well, it wasn't Google yet, but I think I was asking Jeeves.
Okay.
Ask Jeeves was a website.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And then, you know, talking to Carl, you know, what places have these, you know, where would these be most likely be? And some of them were pretty obvious, you know, Seattle, University of Washington, Victoria was kind of, that was obvious, but they were a pain in the neck. So yeah, it's a lot easier today. I probably have a ton more photos today.
Yeah, because it's just, you know, how you track them down and find out that they exist, as you say, back in the time when you couldn't just Google everything.
Kids these days.
No, they just don't know.
They don't know the pain of having to go and...
Did you actually physically went to some of the archives to look at things?
No, you know, I didn't. I actually was able to do everything digitally. Yeah, and order them online, yeah.
Our neighbors.
Yeah, welcome to my new world.
Right.
They moved us here last August saying, oh, it's going to be wonderful. I'm like, yeah.
So other people that you worked with on this project, were there people that you worked with that were helpful to you?
Oh, sure.
Do you have some names in particular that were particularly...
Well, Carl's probably at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. I mean, he needs to write a book or several. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the park needs to do oral histories with him before he walks out, because
some has been done.
Oh, good, I'm glad. You know, Sandy McDermott was amazing and very supportive, you know, because she wanted the book to be a little different than the, you know. And so she was really supportive. And Frank Norris is a historian. Linda Cook was really helpful. She was the person that was the interim.
She was the interim superintendent at Klondike?
Yeah, while I was, when we did the White Pass City field trip. Yeah. And Bruce Noble?
Oh, he might have been superintendent?
Yeah, I think it's Bruce, I don't remember his last name. He was...
Bruce Noble was superintendent at some point. I
okay, I got the name
off the top of my head. Don't know the dates, but
he was there. Yeah, I don't really. And then, you know, people at the railroad. Glenda Choate, Choate, wonderful woman. She's no longer with us. She died of cancer a few years ago. She worked at the railroad. Was very, very helpful. And she and Tina
Sear.
Yep, they would get me on the train. Anytime. And there was, in fact, I've mentioned him in my thanking people, one of the conductors. Because I think, you know, the people of the train, you know, they deal with all these tourists and it's just the same story every day. So for me to want to do something different and get off at a different place, and they let me do it, and it was so much fun. I think they all really got off on it.
I was thinking if it was Carl Mulvihill.
No. I don't remember. But yeah, the people on the train were terrific. And
Lee Hartson.
Lee, yes, yes. Yeah. Great guy. So much fun. And I actually got to ride in the, you know, in the front of the train with the... engineer once.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I was up with my niece and got to do that when she was 12. It was really fun.
Fun.
Yeah.
What you mentioned Glenda, but I think the City Museum in Skagway. Did you have any interaction?
So the City Museum, no, I really didn't. They were remodeling, and so the City Museum really wasn't available.
Oh.
They, you know, they're in the library,
the old
school.
Yeah,
and that was, so I think everything was pretty much packed up most of the time I was doing this, frankly.
Yeah, and Judy Munns is the curator now. I don't know if she was...
I think so.
Then.
I think so, yeah.
Well, it's bad that, you weren't able to use their resources.
Yeah, I don't...
I don't know if they would have had anything. I haven't seen their collections.
Yeah, most of the stuff is Skagway. I mean, I have it in their sense, and most of it was Skagway. I mean, it's great. It's really fun.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, you know, people who were supportive of this project. Were there, besides that historian you talked about, other detractors or people who gave you pushback?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there were probably a few people that wondered how I got such a great gig, but I was on the top of that list. I was like, I don't know how I did this. This is definitely, I got the long straw in this project, and I really did. I just, it's the best job I've ever had. It was so much fun. It was definitely...
Well, and it's great that that's all you were doing.
Well, like, I had a couple other projects.
Oh, you had other projects?
Yeah, there were a couple other projects at the same time, but yeah, I didn't have to be in an office and that, so that was great.
I was thinking about the detractors question. Did you have a sense of how this project was or was not accepted by staff at the park in Skagway because it came from regional? Was there ever... Or did they appreciate having regional's assistance?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I was always treated with respect and always had a lot of fun with the staff there. If there was resentment, I certainly never felt it.
Okay.
I think in Skagway, in fact, they're just so happy to see a different face because it's a small town, you know.
Yeah. Now, did you face your own challenges in putting this together? We've been talking about the hardships and challenges of the people on the trail.
No, I, you know, except for, you know, when my mom got sick, but that was, you know, that's
right.
Certainly nothing. I mean, it was actually a godsend that I had this project that I could work on that I really loved. And then I was able to go back while she was still, the last summer, she had a really good summer before she, you know, between rounds of chemo. So I was able to go back to Skagway. But I was having a blast. I really had a great time doing it. I don't remember any real hardships.
You're talking about the, you know, the importance of the story of the White Pass. I don't know how much is there in the Park Service exhibit area about the White Pass unit.
I don't remember.
And if you feel that how the Park Service is doing about telling those stories of the White Pass.
I don't remember. To be honest, I don't remember being appalled that it wasn't good, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, there's so many stories. So I don't remember being unhappy about the amount.
Yeah, because I was wondering if you had ideas about how they could tell this story of the White Pass better.
Well, I think the railroad could. I think they could do a lot to improve their stories, and perhaps they have. Like I said, my niece was 12 the last time I was on, and she's 26 now. So, so it's been a while since I've been on the train, so it could be quite a bit better now. So, it's a tourist town, so there's going to be the melodrama, there's going to be the shootouts, and of course, mm-hmm. you know, we have. Soapy Smith there, and of course he's from Denver as well.
Right.
So, I'm familiar with the tourist, you know, the campiness of it all, and
right.
how silly it is. One thing that drives me nuts, but you know, I don't think there's anything that we can do about it. Even the cruise lines tell terrible stories. Apparently, I'm not a cruise person, so I don't know. But, you know, the stores on the street. I mean, Yadro porcelain has nothing to do with the gold rush, except that in a way it does, because they're mining the people that came, you know, the people in the stores are doing the same thing that they did, Skagway
right.
did when they were setting up shop. They're making as much money as they can, as quickly as they can, selling whatever they can.
Right.
So in that way, history is repeating itself, but when you got people trying to make a living, they have to do what they have to do.
Right. Having been out into the White Pass unit, do you have any thoughts about things the Park Service could do out there? Like, should they develop a trail like the Chilkoot on the White Pass side, or?
Well, so the idealist in me would say, sure, that'd be awesome. That'd be a great trail. The pragmatist, my job here is I'm manager of historic preservation projects. They're the Park Service's backlog of things. It'll never happen. I mean, I can't imagine it would ever happen. I mean, how much fun would it be to redo the George Brackett, Brackett wagon road? But given the vegetation, it's a rainforest. I can't.
Well, and does the train go on part of the route of the Brackett Road?
Well,
or the Klondike Highway does, or
I think I don't know. Once you get to Liarsville, you know, where it stops going flat, mm-hmm. and both when you're driving and when, you know, the train, I think you're both leaving. There are places on the train where you can look down and see the wagon road. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I don't see it happening. It'd be a great trail.
Yeah, or I was thinking even a trail. Could there be a trail from the train down to White Pass City?
Well, you'd have to do switchbacks, but once again, what would they find down there? I don't know at this point. It's obviously been a long time since I was there. I don't know.
Because I was thinking, as you said, I think there's some hiking up to the glaciers.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, you know, that's
that has nothing to do with a...
No,
with
and that's not established, maintained Park Service trails.
No.
But that's why I was asking, like, could those things be put in that area? And
I suppose, but, you know, I don't know. They need to be. And like I said, given the budget, I don't see that happening. In a way, it's I kind of like how it's mysterious, you know? I mean, everybody likes to take the train when it's beautiful and sunny, and of course I do too, but you know, when the clouds come in as they do and the mist is low, I mean, it's mysterious, and you know, you can kind of feel the people that were there and the activity that was there. And I think it's okay to have mystery. I think mystery is okay. And, you know, with the Chilkoot, you know, you don't really have that. You've got hiking trails, you've got places, you know, warming huts. And you've got tons of other people. So I don't know. I think the mystery is okay.
Okay. I guess that'd be the other question is, are there things about the White Pass story that you feel haven't been told that you'd like to see more research on or wish you could have included in the book?
Well, I think I would probably have liked... I think I probably would have liked to put a little bit more about Skagway in it. And because Skagway, you know, the way it started out is just a place to mine the miners. But then it got to be kind of an interesting little town, you know. It was a really interesting town. What is it, Garden City? Mm-hmm. You know, Frank Norris wrote that little book about the gardens. There's so many really interesting stories. So, I mean, it would probably be a separate book, but, you know, I did talk about Captain Moore and how he thought, you know, this is a place kind of thing. And, And that's a very interesting story there too. I don't know. I think I would probably talk or write more about Skagway itself and how interesting it was. And it was, yeah, because it really was. And it was funny because I don't know if she was a historian or an intern or somebody at the Park Service. Her grandfather lived in Skagway, and I think he worked when the Army was there. Mm-hmm. But he was on McCarthy's American list. And so, they were in Skagway. The un-American committee was in Skagway looking for people. I mean, they were looking for people everywhere. Even Skagway.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah, so it's a very, very interesting little town.
And now what have you done since? This book was published in 2003.
Well, I did a couple other things for the Park Service, and then I got this job, which is the City Boulder Open Space and Mountain Parks, and I was the public information officer first. My master's is in mass communication or public relations, and so I started here doing that, talking about how to avoid bears because I had hiked so much, and you know, that kind of thing. And then they didn't have a cultural resource program here, but the city council decided that we needed one, and so I applied for that and I got it from my previous experience. So City Boulder, we have 46,000 acres around the city of Boulder preserved as open space. And I try to take care of the historic buildings as much as we can. I did a really big rehab last year. I'm working on one this afternoon. I'm headed up into the hills to look at a little cabin that HistoriCorps finished. So that's the kind of thing I do now.
So you moved into buildings.
I love buildings. I love them. In fact, I wanted to be an architect when I was in high school, and a high school counselor told me that women didn't get to be architects. It's very incorrect because I work with a lot of women that are architects. Yes.
When you said you got your master's, mm-hmm. and where was that from?
University of Denver.
Okay. When did you leave Alaska?
2002.
Oh, so you finished this book while you were out already back down here.
Yeah.
You mentioned you had a few other Park Service projects.
I did a lot of DOEs, determination of eligibilities from the National Register. I was in Gustavus. Sweet little place. Oh my God, I love that little place. I don't think I could live there, but what a cool place, you know, and that kind of thing.
So determinant of eligibility for National Register sites, like buildings and, mm-hmm.
yeah.
I guess there's National Historic Register
Yeah, and
areas.
I worked on Seward, you know, because the Visitor Center needed to do some, they needed a DOE for Seward.
And those were also contract projects? So you were never actually a Park Service employee?
Mm-mm.
Well, that probably worked out all right.
Well, I wanted to be, because I really, really, really loved working at the Park Service.
I guess, were there pros and cons to being on contract versus being...
Well, the money ran out, so yeah.
Yeah. okay. Any other things about this White Pass Unit project, or the history of the unit, or Skagway?
No, I just remember it was just a really fun time. It was just really... I know that Sandy was pretty brave, you know, because it was kind of a departure from the norm. And Carl was very kind. I know he would probably have preferred something very, you know, conservative. But no, people were really nice.
Have you gotten any sense of if this is used or how widely distributed it has been?
I don't know, but it has 5 stars on Amazon.com.
There you go.
And I kept one of some professor from a place in California shot an email to Sandy that she sent to me. It was, scholarly yet readable? I'm like, I'll take that.
That's nice.
I'll take that.
And we should say Sandy is now long retired, I think, from the Park Service.
Sadly, yeah, she lives in Los Angeles with her daughter and son-in-law.
Okay.
And son, yeah.
Something else. And so the audience, were you given an assignment for this? Is it, you had to write to a certain audience for this?
No, I don't think so.
Like it was for the public, it was for Park Service employees, or...
I don't remember that discussion. There probably was one, but I don't remember. I don't remember.
And my final question was about the collections of the park, or like the artifacts. Did you do any work with those?
Mm-mm.
You were just diaries and photos?
Yeah. No, I didn't really do anything with the artifacts. I mean, we saw some, like at the top of the, you know, the summit, but through the years, so much of that has walked away.
Yeah.
You know, and they're taking bones up there to make it look like dead horse bones. I'm like, you know, this was over 100 years ago. It's
yeah.
But I think I think maybe the railroad people do that so that the tourists can take pictures. And I'm in a bunch of tourist pictures,
oh,
too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, let's take a picture.
They weren't expecting a chick in the top of the summit, that's for sure.
Well, was it a conscious decision not to use artifacts? Like, because the park has, you know, artifact collections. Like, why you didn't go look into that?
No. I guess I didn't. It's a book. I guess I tend to, well, how would I have used them in the book?
That's my question.
I don't know. Yeah.
That whether you thought
unless
about
there were
that.
Photos. No. Yeah. No, I didn't really think of that. It wasn't that long ago, to be honest. A lot has changed.
Right.
But it wasn't that long ago. Cans are still cans.
Right.
Canvas is still canvas. And leather boots are still leather boots. So I don't know that would have been. I think you can put the story together without seeing what it was. I don't know.
Well, you felt the photos did that for you.
Well, yeah, sure. There are artifacts in some of those photos, especially that one of that gentleman at his tent having coffee.
Yeah, that's a good photo.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? That's a nice story too. I mean, he went back and had a real life.
Yeah, so he's actually named in the photo, which is not always so common. Ainsworth.
Yeah.
And so you were able to find out something about him?
Yeah, I went back and had a life. Yeah, I don't remember a whole lot about him.
Yeah, I mean, you have lots of, you know, the quotes you have attributed to specific people, and that's all from their diaries.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty amazing, because that's a lot of people.
It is.
And I didn't realize that John Muir was up there at that time period.
Yep.
The Slobbery Bog.
I think, was he on the Harriman expedition?
Expedition?
I know that...
yeah, he was.
I think he was, and I know that there was, it wasn't Audubon, but the other one that has three names that loved birds so much that they shot him.
That was Audubon.
Yeah, but there was another one. It's Jose something, I think.
Oh, that was the norm at the time.
Yeah, it was.
But they did, as you say, you know, the horses, it was the norm. They were, and they didn't use sled dogs on the White Pass?
I think there were some, sure.
But it was more of a horse trail.
Yeah, I don't think dogs were very available.
Well, and again, the people coming from outside would have had even less experience with running a dog team.
No kidding.
That would have been...
Oh, my God.
That would have been somebody guiding them, taking them.
The Iditarod would never happen if those were inexperienced mushers trying to get the serum to know.
And so that's what I don't know. Were there packers? I mean, that people could hire somebody to take their stuff?
Sure.
And those guys, did they kill their horses too, or they were better?
I think overall they were better because it was their business, but I think, they killed their horses too.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the photos, and it's men pulling their own sleds.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
And the Chilkoot as well.
Yeah, here's a few dogs, but they may have been, you know, just individual with pack sacks on, not actually pulling a sled. Unless you have anything else you want to add.
No, I don't.
I approached you about this, that you want to make sure you got covered.
No, it was just a really fun project, and I hope I did a good job. I think I did. It was fun.
What is how you went from knowing nothing about the White Pass unit, right? It sounds like you kind of fell in love with the story.
Oh, I sure did. I sure did. In spite of the horse story.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, we just need to remember to take today's filter and our judgments on today and not place them on what people did. And not just in the White Pass, oh, for God. I mean, in everything in history. I mean, you know, they had different times and there were different mores and different social and different pressures. And for sure, you know, people talk about the good old days, and I'm not sure there ever were any really good old days, you know, because everybody's always had trouble.
Right.
You know, one of Brackett's sons died of the flu. You know, I think it was the youngest one that was married to Molly. I mean, horrible things happen all the time and to all people in history. And I think it would be great if we weren't so judgmental. And we're really judgmental now, especially with social media. And it's just so easy to not know people. And so I think it's really, if there's one thing I would like people to just take off your lens and try to empathize and try to see where they were coming from.
And any thoughts about how you'd like to see this book or this history of White Pass get carried further into the future?
Oh, it should definitely be a movie. And Julia Roberts should play me. You know, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I should go up to Skagway and immerse myself back into it all and maybe have some ideas. I don't know. As long as there's tourism, and there has always been tourism in Alaska, and there probably always will be, I think it'll exist to some extent. I just wish it were more accurate, but...
But it sounds like you feel like you covered the history, and other than individual people's stories, the history of the White Pass is done?
Oh, no. I mean, how cool would it be to have a whole study on White Pass City? I mean, that would be fun. And then, you know, or to have a whole book about the Brackett Wagon Road. I'm sure there's a whole story there. There is a story about the White Pass Railroad, and it's a really good book. I used it heavily. I mean, those stories would be really fun to tell.
Because the development of the railroad kind of eliminated the use of the trail and that Brackett Road.
Oh, yeah, sure. And, you know, right about the time when the train was done, gold was discovered in Nome.
end of the heyday in Skagway.
Yeah, and until tourism.
Right.
And then, well, the Alaska Highway was part of it. I think that kept them going for a while, and then... Than tourism now, I think, is about the only thing they've got. I haven't been there in a while, but...
Yeah, in a park.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. I know we've got
sure.
other things to do today, so thank you for your time this morning.
Sure, of course.